Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast and have a great day.
So, Women's Retreat, held in the Westminster Woods Camp and Conference Center in Occidental, California, on January 21st, 22nd, and 23rd, 2005. The main speaker is Mildred F. of Canada. The theme of this is the spirituality of the steps.
Welcome, everybody. We're really glad you're here. This is the first annual Redwood Women's Retreat, and this is the spirituality of the steps. So it's so good to see everybody. Welcome. Just have a couple of announcements tonight. Well, actually, seven. Somebody's always running up to me saying, do this, so I'm going to do it. Phone numbers for the two houses. The retreat house has a phone number with no answering machine. The hilltop house has a phone number but no answering machine. And actually, rather than give it out if you don't have a pen, if you'd like to see me, and I'll give you those phone numbers. The main Westminster phone number will be staffed Friday and Saturday till 5. And 874-2426, but I think it's probably on the brochure, I would imagine. And we do have a camp host number for off hours, and I can also give that to you after we're through. And committee members are wearing orange ribbons. I thought it would be nice if the committee people stood up so you know who they are. Wouldn't that be nice? There goes the day. We have some amazing talent in this group. I'm just, it's phenomenal.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. I'm Libby, and I'm your chairperson. So I guess really the only thing I'd like to do is just tell you how this whole thing got started. And a group of us went to the International Women's Convention last year, which was held in Buffalo. And my ears really perked up when I heard this lady speak, because she was speaking about something that I was just really getting interested in and reading some books about. So I was right on the edge of my seat the whole time, and the chair was wonderful and uplifting and just everything you'd want it to be. It actually, if it would have been for nothing else, I would have traveled to Buffalo, you know, just for that. So I finally got up the nerve to go speak with her on Saturday. She had spoken on Thursday. And, you know, I was asking her, how do you do that, the thing that she was talking about? I said, do you have to have a lot of years? Does it just come with time? She says, no, you just do it. So she gave me an assignment. She said, go do this tonight and come find me at breakfast. So I was thinking, I'm glad she's not my sponsor. Anyways, so I did go find her breakfast, and, you know, she was drawing me these diagrams and talking with me. And then she was telling me that she goes all over and does retreats for people. And she said, you know, if your group would like, I could come there sometime and do a retreat. So we went back to the table where the group of us were, and they were all, of course, instantly, you know, excited about it and said, yes, we like that. So we came home and formed a committee, and that's how this thing got started. So we've been working on it, you know, since last February. And, you know, the great thing is the fact that we're doing the retreat, of course. And the other thing was that a lot of, you know, it's like one of those ripple effect type things. You know, just, you know, from just hearing this, the Mildred speak, to forming the committee, to the whole year, it's like it's brought people close together on the committee, and, you know, a lot of unfolding and just great things, like miracle kind of things. It's just been a great year. And, you know, This, here it is now. So that's it, and I'd like to introduce Mildred.
My name is Mildred, and I am a grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I come from a land where today it is minus 35 below. You know, sometimes people have the idea, I think, that we live in ice and snow perpetually, and we've had actually a very pleasant winter, except for a few days. But I was speaking to one of my friends this morning, and she said that it's minus 35 with the wind chill factor, so I'm in a great place. Livy and I have had some interesting communications. She kept writing me and saying, well, you know, I'm a little nervous about this rustic place. I'm a little nervous. I think this place might be very rustic. I said, how rustic is it? So at last we're here. And I've been in lots more rustic places, so it's wonderful to be here. I'd really like to comment on the committee and on Libby's keeping in communication and making an effort. You know, I'm a member of AA. That's what I am. You know, my identity is not a giver of retreats. I have been treated so special. I have been treated to such courtesy. I have been treated in a way that doesn't always happen. Not because some people just don't have that sense. What a great committee these women are who have put this on. I can tell you, they are extraordinary. They have made an effort to look after everything possible that could possibly be for my comfort. And as I say, I don't think that that has to happen to me. I'm just a member of AA who comes and shares because I've been asked to do so. But when you see that kind of thing, it's really touching. And I want you all in the committee to know that none of what you have done, from the flowers to the dinner to the welcome to the every consideration for my comfort, has gone unnoticed. And that isn't about me. That tells me about who you are. And that's just wonderful. Let's give them a really good round of applause. You know, and while they were at it trying to make sure that I was comfortable, I know they've also tried to make sure that you are comfortable and that everything has been done so that this first retreat that we're having is a great success and that you feel comfortable. I'll try to take care of what I have to take care of, and they certainly have made an effort to take care of your physical needs and your comfort in every way possible in this very rustic place. So I think that's taken care of. So I'd like to introduce what we're going to be doing. Libby and I talked about, some things that we could do at this retreat. And she said, you know, we'd like to have you back every year. And I said, well, if we're going to do that, I'd like to start with the spirituality of the steps. I'm no expert on the steps. I'm a member of AA. That's who I am. And so I have some ideas about my experiences, and those are the things that I can share with you. I can tell you right now, if I say something that doesn't agree with how you feel about it, just ignore, take a look at it, see if there's something you should look at, but don't think because I say it that it's gospel truth. You know that. You have to look at your own soul. This retreat is about you and your God. This retreat is about you and yourself. This retreat is about you and your brothers and sisters on the planet. That's what this is about. You know, I think the most important question that I ever have had to face is, who am I here? What am I doing here? Am I here to give retreats? am I here to come to Santa Rosa and then go someplace else and then speak at a... Is that what life is about? Is that what I'm going to be... My life is going to be decided... The goodness of my life is going to be determined by? What is this journey all about? How can I live here in a reasonable degree of comfort? How can I achieve something and still feel good about myself? How can I accept the conditions of my life? You know, and I think out of that comes the big question. Do I believe that God is everything or that God is nothing? And I think the whole theme of what I have to say is really about this. How is my walk with God? How is my walk with God? Because what that brings up is, see, I come from a world where I tried to use God to run away from the world. I thought everybody was a craphead. And so I'm going to go and be spiritual, and I'm going to find God. And I'm going to run to that, and that's going to make it possible for me to deal with my life. Has anybody here ever had that idea? It's not going to work. It's not going to work. My experience has been that as long as I thought I was going to use finding God to run away from the world and life, I didn't find that. And I didn't find happiness in this part of my life either. Because I think it works this way. That as you find your God, you find yourself. And as you find yourself, you find your brother. And all three have to be your brother and your sister. Because all three have to be there. Because if you find one or the other, it's lopsided. And so, that's what we need to talk about this week. The steps in relationship to that. Because that's what I think it's really all about. There was a great teacher on the planet 2,000 years ago, and he told the story of this young woman. A rich man had two daughters, and the youngest of the daughters said, "You know, Papa, it sucks around this place. I don't like it here. You know, the way you run this household and the way you run the business, I want to get out of here. I want my inheritance, and I'm going to go and see the world." And that's what she did. And the father, you note, didn't argue. He gave her the inheritance because she had choice, and if she wanted to be away, she had to go. And she went. And the book says she lived riotously, and she spent all her money, and there came a famine upon the land. And it says, and no person gave her anything. You know why? Because what was wrong with her, no person could fix. And she wound up in the pig pen, looking after the pigs and eating what the pigs left over. You know, this was a story told by a Jewish man. This would have been a Jewish girl in a pig pen. You know that history. Jewish people are not supposed to be with the pigs. And she was in the pig pen eating what the pigs left over. I think what he was saying was she was in a state of incomprehensible demoralization. Maybe the first, well, not the first one, but certainly an alcoholic on record. And she got a bright idea. She said, "You know what? My papa has servants who feed the pigs. The only thing is my papa treats his servants better than this guy does. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go home and I'm going to grovel a bit. And I'm going to say to my dad, you know, I've really made a big mistake in leaving home. And, you know, I don't ask for anything, but could I go and feed the pigs in your pig pen?" That was her plan. You ever hear of an alcoholic who says, I think I'll sober up so my life will be better. I'll sober up so my husband comes back. I'll sober up so my kids like me. I'll sober up so I get back my stuff. That's what she was doing. She was trying to get not even into the house. She was just trying to get back and have a little better food. But something must have happened. Because it says along the way, I think she did her steps 1, 2, and 3. And then she did 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 because by the time she got home, she'd had a spiritual awakening. She didn't think anymore like she did in the pig pen. Because when she got home, she didn't say, let me go to the pig pen. Because she knew she didn't belong in the pig pen. She was the daughter of the household. She belonged in the house. And she must have realized something else. She must have realized the unconditional love of her father for her because she was his child. So when she got home, she said, Papa, I have sinned. I made a mistake before heaven and before thee. And he had the robe ready. He had the ring ready. He said, kill the fatted calf, we're going to have a party. This daughter of mine has been lost and is come home. And we're going to have a party, and he put that robe of welcome on her. You can imagine she probably didn't smell so good. She probably didn't look so good. Like many of us as we came inside the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we were wrapped around with the love that is available in Alcoholics Anonymous, if we are doing what we ought to be doing here. She was welcomed home, and she was given the ring, which would be, in those days, like a platinum American Express card with the father's insignia on it. And she could go anywhere in the kingdom, and she could take anything because she had the ring with the father's insignia on it. Now there's another player. So we've looked at the daughter who goes away and comes back because she's had a change inside. She sees something different. We've looked at the father of unconditional love. He didn't sit there and say, you know what? You surely behaved badly. You know, you're going to come home and you're going to do some penance, and then I'll see. See if you really got the message. But the way you are, you're not getting into the house. Take her out and put her under the shower and get her cleaned up for God's sake, and we'll see how things go. He knew she'd had a change of heart, and she was welcomed back. That's what this is all about. It's not about trying to accomplish something so that you will become good and acceptable. We are good and acceptable right now. Not because of the way we look or the way we dress or anything else, but because of who we are. You know, our big book says it. Deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And that doesn't mean an airy-fairy thought. That means your experience of who you are, that fundamental life force that lives within you. There's another player in that picture. The older brother. He didn't get it. The older sister, pardon me. I'm changing genders. Not really, just in the story. He was out working. She! And said, grumbled. How's that possible? That little whippersnapper went and took her inheritance, and she wasted it, and now she comes back And I have been working, and I don't get a party made for me. You see, this one didn't understand about grace. Grace means unconditional love, the activity of God in our lives. That's really what grace is, I think. That right now, to the extent that you will allow it, God works in your life. When you say yes, it's not about, I have to wait till tomorrow. Tomorrow is an illusion. Yesterday is an illusion. The only moment that we have is this one. And I'm not going to be more acceptable because I say three more Hail Marys or because I do this or I do that. It's about our identity. And tomorrow morning we're going to talk about a case of mistaken identity. And so, if we can come away from this retreat loving ourselves a little more, this will have been a great success. It doesn't really matter what somebody else thinks about you. It matters what I think about me. And it matters what you think about you. And it matters what you can, if you can put your arms around you and say, ah, you are fabulous. I love you. It's not dependent on what the older brother was thinking, that it was dependent on his goodness. It's dependent on what's in our hearts. I personally think it's one of the most difficult things. It's one of the things that takes the longest for some of us, and that is to learn to love ourselves. To be able to put the head on the pillow at night and say, you know what, you screwed up today, Mildred, but you're a good girl. I love you. You're doing good. Let's get out there tomorrow. You know what happens when you can do that? When I love myself and when I can see myself, you look a hell of a lot better. Do you know that? And if I don't feel good about myself, you don't look so good either. And in the days when I was going to find God, because you were all crap heads, and I didn't like what you were doing, I was really not liking what I was doing. And it was all about the way I was seeing the world. So I'd like to share a few things about my life, just briefly, so you have some idea of who I am. And then I'd like to talk just a little bit about the direction I'd like to go in this retreat. And then I'll give you a little exercise if you'd like to do something. It's up to you. But since we're going to really go through the steps, you can make this an intensive doing of the steps. You know, I never get better because I talk about the steps. I don't get better because I give retreats or talk about the steps. I get better if I take these principles and actually do something about them and apply them to some area of my life. And that's why at the end you're going to see, I'm going to ask you tonight, if you want to, you know, we're all going to come away with something, but if and what you choose to do is your business. So I just want to talk a minute about retreats because I think some people have never been to a retreat. My experience is this. When you look at God, God looks at you. God looks at you anyway. But when you look back, something magical happens. When you put time aside for God, God put special time aside for you. God is always there. God is always in you. God is always around you and me and everybody else. But something happens. You know, it's like being in a room with somebody and you know that person is there and they know you're there. But when you look at each other and when you communicate in consciousness, something magical happens. A communication is made. Just like when you look at yourself in the mirror, a communication is made. When you consciously, not to look at the lines and the lumps and the wrinkles, but to actually look into your eyes and say, I see you in there. I see who I am. I'm beautiful. I'm wonderful. I am the presence of God in this body. And when you can see that, some magical communication takes place. And I always think that when you come to a retreat, the God of surprises comes with you. And you don't know what will happen in these 40 hours or so that we are together. But if you have the idea, and why would you be at a retreat? People come for different reasons. But you had an option. You didn't have to be here tonight. What are you here for? Are you here to see your friends? That's good. Are you here to see what that ex-nun from Toronto is going to talk about? That's good too. Or are you here for a closer walk with God? If you're here for that, I guarantee you that when you leave here on Sunday, something fundamental will have happened in your soul. You might not know it, but it will have happened. I promise you that. So, who am I? Well, I was born on the prairies, actually. So, if you would go to North Dakota, South, and Ohio, and those... Nebraska, in that area. Your Midwest extends up into Canada. And I was born in a town called Humboldt, Saskatchewan, or outside of town, and on a farm. Hated it! Hated being German. You know, I don't know if we lived before, but I sure came onto the planet screwed up. Oh, mensch. Some people say, you know, they had a happy childhood. Not me. I was fighting from the moment I became conscious. And what I was really fighting about was, well, didn't like the farm. I was the youngest of 10 kids. I thought that was obscene. We were Roman Catholic, German. What else? Well, anyway, what really came to the fore was that somebody that I loved dearly cried every night, and she'd crawl into bed with me. I'm 72, so we're talking about 69 years ago. And I don't think the educational system is totally enlightened now, but it sure was not totally enlightened in those days. And my sister had been injured at birth. She couldn't learn as fast as other kids. And so they said she was dumb. They said her name was Dorothy. They called her Dumb Dora, the kids in the neighborhood. They kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. Can you imagine that? And she used to crawl. You know, we all need comfort. And she came for comfort to me. I was 3 1/2 and she was 16. And she'd cry and she'd say, Mildred, why was I ever born? Why didn't I die in the cradle? And I used to lie there and cry with her. And I'd say, Dora, I don't know, why was I ever born? Why didn't I die in the cradle? And we'll talk a little more about that whole business of identification and how we take on ideas, etc. But if you had taken a 2x4 and hit me across the back, you wouldn't have hurt me more than that did. I didn't know how to handle that. And I started my manipulation because my goal in life was to stop the crying. I had no other goal. Stop Dora crying. And I went to my family members. And they, you know, according to my perceptions, and hear me when I say that, according to my perceptions, they were cruel and hard-hearted because they didn't stop the crying. See, I didn't know that it wasn't because they wouldn't stop it. I thought it was because they wouldn't stop it. I know today it was because they couldn't. Each of us has our journey. That was her journey. And as I'll tell you later, she came to peace years later. As my Jesuit spiritual director says, God doesn't need a big intellect to grow our souls. She came to peace, but at that point in her life, she wasn't at peace. And I sure wasn't at peace either. And so I put up the walls. I had an idea. I'm right and you're wrong. I mean, my sister is crying there and you're not helping me. You're all stupid and hard-hearted and I'm right. That's a good message to go through life with. I hate you all. That's another good message to go through life with. And I'm sure you don't care about me either. That's another good message to go through life with. And that's the way I did. And I put up the walls. See, I'm telling you this in hindsight. And sometimes I think, when I came in, which was the first time in 1966, and I think I heard correctly, people sort of had the idea, well, don't get into all that childhood stuff. I think it's very important that we know who we are as little children, because the woman you are today is the child you were. My personality was formed. My belief system was formed in that way. I don't have to stick with that. I'm a person of choice. That's where I think our spiritual work is. Look at what Bill Wilson says. You know, isn't this beautiful? I come to do the spirituality of the steps and I leave my book in the house. It's okay. I'll bring it tomorrow. But in the 12 and 12, in step 8, he talks about this, that we have had experiences which we've since buried, which have discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse. That was not written by Jung. It was not written by Freud. It was not written by a psychologist. It was written by Bill Wilson, because he knew about that process. That as children, we're sponges. We suck that stuff up. And don't hear me say, well, let's whine about it for the rest of our lives. And let's blame Mama and Daddy. And let's get into the inner child stuff. And if we just rock ourselves enough, it'll all go. No, it won't. It's not going to go away until I get to know who I am and I know how to do it. You know, I can't find it again, but I read Bill Wilson, something that he had written, somebody gave to me. And he talked about his childhood and his difficulties with his mother. And he says that he made a decision that he had better be number one. Doesn't his life bear that out? His struggle to be somebody. And what he did and how it manifested in his life. Because I see, when I look at things that he's written and said, the boy he was, the child he was the man he became. And to me, this is the beauty of it. Because each of us can take those experiences, and that's what the steps offer us. Not to put away and act as if it didn't happen. I often say to people, honor what happened to you. Honor it. Get to know it. Because oftentimes I find, I didn't know this stuff about me. And I remember the first time somebody talked to me about this stuff. It was maybe 15 years ago. And we were discussing this business with Dora. And I remember sitting at the dinner, we were in a fine restaurant, and I looked up from my dinner, and he was crying. For me. The tears were rolling down his cheeks. And I think for the first time in my life, I felt a real connection to the planet. I felt a real connection to my life. We need a witness. Not somebody to listen to our whining. That's not what I'm saying. We need a witness to who you are. Every single person in this room had a childhood. And I'll bet you if we took them and we had the time to hear each sacred story. There are tears in every life. And those are the tears and those are the experiences that have molded you. Those are sacred because it's out of that that you have grown and you have flowed. As you can see in my life, you know, that those were the ideas. And any psychologist worth their soup will tell you this happens by the time we're five. It's not a conscious thing that we decide is going to happen. It just happens. We suck up what we see. We suck up what we hear. We make those decisions. I can see as I look back, my decisions were, you're all stupid, you're hard-hearted, you're cold, I don't trust you. You're supposed to fix my life. I'm 3 1/2, you're adults, and you're not doing your job, and I'm not going to trust you again. And I put up the walls. And those walls weren't taken down till 10 or 11 years ago. And that's when I started to grow. That's when I started to let life in, and my life started to take off. You know, it's not about time, and it's not about how long you're sober, and it's not about your chronological age. It's about none of that. And, you know, I'm 72, and I just feel some days I'm just starting to wake up. Life is just right there in my hands. You know, I sat in my room this morning, and I thought, oh, my God. And, you know, the temptation is to say the hours were wasted. They're not. I had an experience this morning as I sat in my room in Santa Rosa. I brought my CD player along, and I have a nice set of speakers. I travel a lot, so there's some things I take with me. And I was listening to a Mozart horn concerto. And I was sitting on the bed, and I had my breakfast there, some beautiful fresh fruit and cereal. And I was looking out the window, and I had the memory of last night in my heart. And I was thinking about God, and I didn't have anything else to do. And it was such a complete moment. It was a moment of such wonder. And I thought, the thought crossed my mind, how many hours, how many experiences have I wasted? But nothing is wasted. Every one of the experiences of life. It's not about, again, how old you are or how long you've been sober or what you've done or what you haven't done. Just be here. Just suck it up. In the moment. And let it be, and you'll grow, because that's where you meet God. And whatever it is, it is. I can't be other than I am right now. And you can't be other than you are right now. You know, there's no ectomy that we can take, the old beliefs ectomy, and just say, they're not there anymore. They're wound into everything that you do. And they will be, I believe, until the day we die. It's not without reason that step 7 says, I give you the good and the bad. I'll tell you right now, I'm not on the planet to become good. I'm here to become totally dependent on God. Totally dependent on God. You know, Chuck Chamberlain many years ago, well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, at 5, I took a drink. And for the next 35 years, that's what I chased. There wasn't anything I wouldn't do for a drink. In the convent or out. That's an interesting part, isn't it? If you need to drink, you need to drink. And what it takes is what it takes. You know that, don't you? Or are you, my skirt's all lily white. I bet there's some stories out there. I was two people, you know. When I was drinking, I danced on the tabletop. When I wasn't drinking, I sat there, had nothing to say. I was just like my brother. My brother who died 4 years ago, he was 49 years sober. But when I was a little girl, he was in his cuffs, and they said he was going to die. And then one day after I got to the convent, I got this amazing letter from my dad. And he said, your brother has been transformed. Transformed was the word he used. And in the 15, I guess it was about 15 years more that my father lived, he could never talk about my brother being sober, but he cried. You know, I think sometimes AA's here. Lots of meetings, we run into a meeting and out of a meeting and do so unconsciously. My father said, this new thing has come to the prairies. He said, they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I don't know what it is. This would have been the early 50s. Said, I don't know what it is. But he said, all I know is it's good. Your brother is transformed. He works. Sure sign of transformation. No, but he said he doesn't drink anymore because the doctor said he was going to die and they didn't know why. And I was just like my brother. Sober, I was self-conscious, self-absorbed, had nothing to say. Drinking, I was another person. See, at 18, I decided to go to the convent. And it was a deal with God. And I'm afraid. I'm afraid of life. Because when I'm that little girl, and I've got a problem, a legitimate problem, and nobody seems to care, I'm scared. What if I go to the big city? I mean, I can admit this now. I couldn't for years because I didn't know it. What if I go to the big city and I have a problem? I better not do that. Because if I have a problem, nobody's going to help me. And I can't fix it. I couldn't fix my sister Dora. And if I couldn't fix that, I can't fix anything. And so I better play it safe. Well, what better place to go than a convent? A little problem there when you're alcoholic. In the 1950s, with those long black dresses and, you know, all that stuff, I managed. I was telling a group of men the other night, you know, when all else failed, I'd go and get drunk and hide in the confessional. Nobody thought to look for me there. You know, I don't know what time I started. Does anybody?
About
28. So about half an hour.
We've got more.
Okay. So, I stayed in the convent for 15 years. And at the end of that time, Mother Superior called me and she said, you know, sister, you're not happy here, are you? And I remember thinking, what's she talking about? Who's happy? And so I got out of the convent. And I remember January the 10th, 1966, standing on the convent steps. And I was sure. I had my secular clothes back. I had my secular name. I was no longer Sister Mary Eugenia. I no longer had to keep the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Had fiddled around with them a little bit anyway. Fine-tuned them. And I remember thinking, I'm okay. You know, and I think about that. I was a well-educated young woman. I had spent a lot of those 15 years at university studying theology and whatever, whatever, whatever. Didn't know a thing. I didn't know the problem was inside. And out I go. I need to drink, and I found the bars. I loved the bars. I found the men there, and I don't need to tell you what happened. It was like a moral landslide. I mean, if you want to think about, you know, I think every time I see those big water slides, I think, yeah, ooh, right down into the mud. And it wasn't 10 months, and I wasn't drinking with lower companions. I had become the lower companion. People ran when they saw me. It doesn't take long. Degradation does not take long, because it was the degradation of what was inside. And, you know, sometimes I hear people say, alcohol took me down. Alcohol didn't take me down. What took me down was defiance of God, my hatred of my brothers and sisters on the planet, my hatred of myself. And, if you know, I'm grateful to the alcohol. It saved me till I could get to a place where I would surrender and accept the program. I wouldn't have made it. I wouldn't have made it to 40 years of age. Not the kind of person I was. You don't get to be the kind of person that I am. And people say, don't come near our door. If you do, we'll call the police and have you arrested. I was a nasty little piece of business, I tell you. I've been hospitalized 32 times, locked up in psych wards, mental institutions, and insane asylums. Don't have to worry. I won't come rapping on your door tonight. I'm safe. I've had 38 shock treatments. That should give you a permanent shuffle. You know, been tied to the bed many times, and not with Good Time Charlie either. Married my psychiatrist. They said it was cheaper. He too was alcoholic. When I met him, he was sober. You know, I like to think about my relation. Well, I say I had relationships. What I had was parasitic entanglements. Deals. Deals made in hell. He was not my problem. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1966. Dr. Hoffer recommended that I go. Dr. Hoffer knew Bill Wilson. He knew about AA. And he recommended, he said, we've misdiagnosed. And I'm doing AA. I'm trying to read the steps. I'm trying to do a fifth step. I'm trying to go on 12-step calls. Now, that's an interesting one. Cease Cargill always says I carried the disease rather than the message. And at the end of that time, I just left AA. I was so sick. Not of you. I was so sick of me. So ashamed. I thought, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. They're all okay. Ha, ha, ha. I'm not. Out I went. And in 3 days, I had broken a foot and all kinds of stuff. I was drinking again. This is a serious business, you know. The book says you're not going to stay sober because you are afraid. I've had DTs. I've had convulsions that they thought I was going to die. I've eaten the insides of my mouth out a couple of times. I've seen things that weren't there many times. I had blackouts. Like, I guess I pretty well had it all. And it wouldn't stop me today, and it didn't stop me then. I had to play it out. You know, the amazing thing about this is when you start drinking, the circle is big. Alcohol promises it all, doesn't it? I mean, if anybody had said to me at 5 when I took that first drink and had that wonderful feeling of elation and freedom, and that's what the program is there to give me, that wonderful feeling that it's all okay. I'm an ease and comfort junkie, aren't you? That's what Dr. Silkworth says. We're restless, irritable, and discontent. And I would say manipulative, controlling, witchy, bitchy, cheating, whatever you want to add to that, depressive and whatever, until I can again experience ease and comfort. And he there said, that come from taking a few drinks. What if I could get ease and comfort from practicing the steps, from turning my will and my life over to the care of God? Wouldn't that be something? Then I don't have to do it the other way. See, because you start out on that big spiral, and the circle gets smaller, and alcohol gives you less and less and less and less and less, until it gives you nothing but heartache and absolute despair, till it's robbed you of everything, as it did me. When I got done, I had no home, I had no money, I had no self-confidence. There wasn't a person in the world to call. You know, I think, who would I have called? Nobody wanted to hear from me. Isn't that amazing? If I'd have had the money, I was in the psych ward, and the morning, I'd been there 2 nights, and I made a decision the morning of May the 20th. My dry date is May the 18th, 1973. But I made a decision that morning to take my life, and I wasn't deciding, you know, that somebody's going to feel sorry for me. I was out. I'm done. I am done. I know how to do it. And I called the nurse and asked her to get my clothes. And she went out to get my clothes, I presume. And the absolute unbelievable thing happened. I had a spiritual experience, and in the twinkling of an eye, the compulsion to drink was gone. I had fought that. No, I hadn't fought it. I had succumbed to it. I had lived with that compulsion, and there wasn't much that I hadn't done because of it. And in the twinkling of an eye, it was gone. And I knew it was gone. It was as if something had just whooped right into me, picked it up, pulled it out, and said, it's done. And I knew it was gone. I knew I didn't have to drink anymore. I'm sober now 31 years and 8 months, and in that time I've never had the compulsion to drink, never had to fight it. You know, I think it's in the doctor's opinion, he says we need an entire psychic change. I had an entire psychic change in relationship to alcohol. It was gone, it was done. Like that. And I remember sitting there. I hated God. I didn't know what this was. I couldn't have told you then. I remember saying, whatever you are, I don't know how to live this way. Because I'd been sober many times, never pulled it off. Because a week would go by, 2 weeks would go by, 3 weeks would go by, and I'd think, I think I can have a drink now. And I'd be off and running again. That way I'd go. And I don't know how to live this way. If you'll send me somebody, I'll do what they tell me, said I. I remember hearing myself say those words. There was a rap on the door right then. I'm not telling you a story. I wouldn't do that about something as serious as this. It really happened just that way. And there was a rap on the door, and a man stood there, and I think he really was there. He said, I saw you at breakfast. He said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes, I am. Do you want to make something of it? He said, no. He said, I just came. He said, you look sick. He said, I thought I've got a big black, you know, big purple mark, no teeth, or some teeth knocked out. My hair is straggly. He said, I came to offer you some help. And it was through his auspices that I got to a treatment center, and I got to the right one. I got to a hospital. You know, one of the pioneers in offering good medical care to alcoholics was Dr. Bell from Toronto. And it was his hospital, his clinic, that I went to. Things started to happen that shouldn't have happened. But they did. You know, and as I stand here 31 years and 8 months, I can tell you that the direction my life has taken has not been by my good management. It has been by a power greater than myself that I have cooperated with. See, and I didn't used to talk about what happened that morning. But why shouldn't I? It's not about me. But I did cooperate. You see, what I think is, grace is always available. I think the room is filled with the presence of God. Grace is available for whatever it is that you need right now. It just won't show up the way you think it should. Because God is not our servant. God is not someplace else. And I think that gift is always offered. Whatever the gift needs to be, it's always offered. And I think the mystery is, I don't know when you're ready to say yes, and you don't know when I'm ready to say yes. Those are not our prerogatives. That's why all the great masters have said to us, do not try to control anybody's life. It is a dangerous business. That's why we don't lecture here. What we do is share so that people, if you're ready, can hear, can take. Who knows where their soul is? I don't know. Don't know where my soul is. That's why the business of being in the now becomes such a sacred business. And so through that whole thing, I got to the right place. I hated God, hated AA. So where did I go? I went to a hospital where they didn't preach AA and they didn't talk about God. They fed you. They helped you get your head together a little bit. They let you get laid if you had to get laid. Did I say that? Yes. Shows what I was up to, doesn't it? But they didn't lay on a whole lot of God stuff. They didn't make you go to AA. It was perfect for me. And then when I left, they gave me a little money, to get a room on Skid Row. And I lived on Skid Row for a year. I lived with poverty such as, you know, I remember not having food for a day or two or three. I remember having 40 cents in my hand, and that was all that was between us and having absolutely nothing. My husband, you know, he couldn't get past, and I don't say that as a judgment, and as the years go by, I have more and more compassion for him. He couldn't get past the fact that he was a psychiatrist, that he was a surgeon, that he had run programs, and here he was sitting on Skid Row, and he used to say, I'm so depressed, and he was. He did get back to AA eventually. He's dead now. We were divorced by that time. But, you know, anyway, that's the way the first year was. At 6 months sober, I didn't have a program those first 6 months. I just put one foot ahead of the other, got a little job making $2.20 an hour, and went back every day, and I'd open the door to that place, and I'd go, oh. And, you know, I knew it was nobody else had put me there. I knew that. I wasn't there because of my mama. And I wasn't there because of my brothers and sisters. I was there because of me. And I couldn't have explained that, but I knew it to be the truth. And I used to think and criticize my brothers and sisters and my mom and dad. You know, they're farmers, and they didn't have this, and that, and I could tell you all why, you know, what was wrong with them. And I look back, and I realize they gave me great gifts. They gave me in my soul and in my spirit the gift of integrity. They gave me the gift of strength. They gave me the gift of keeping on when it was tough. You know, my mom and dad were both Americans, and came to Saskatchewan because free land was offered. So they were the pioneers of Saskatchewan. So they knew those things. They knew about keeping on when life was difficult and putting... And I didn't know that that was a gift that had been given to me by those parents that I felt so critical toward. Anyway, I was sober and clean 6 months when one day I'm going through the institution, because they used to have Sunday morning programs there, and a man met me, and he smiled at me. I just remember that so clearly, and he said, "Would you like to come to a meeting with me?" I didn't know what kind of meeting. He didn't say an AA meeting. If he had, I might have said, "Go to hell." He said, "Would you like to come to a meeting with me?" I said, "Sure." I went with him, and it was my reintroduction to AA. Only this time I was clean and sober. I don't remember much except that people said, "Keep coming back." They were a wonderful group of people. They looked out for the newcomer, and they didn't care that I didn't look good. They didn't care that I didn't have nice clothes, and they didn't care that I didn't have anything clever to say. I was a broken human being. That's what I brought here. They said, "Keep coming back." And I did. And it took about 3 months, and I fell in love with this program. And that's just a love affair that has grown and grown and grown. And I've done lots of stupid stuff in AA. I've done lots of stuff that I regret, but one thing I have done, I've stayed here. I've stayed connected. I've always had a home group since I came here. I've always attended my home group. I'm a participating member at my home group. You know, every once in a while, some of the young fellows, they see me lifting chairs or whatever. And they come running, you know. "You shouldn't be doing this." And I say, "Why shouldn't I?" Or they see me in the kitchen, you know, and they say, "Now, you go out and just talk to somebody. You don't have to do this anymore." "Oh, yes, I do. I need to do it now more than I did years ago. I need to continue to be of service. And not just the showy service. I need to do the service in the kitchen, washing out the sink and washing out the coffee pots and that kind of stuff." I've stayed here. I've always had a sponsor. I've always been a sponsor. I've always been active, you know, in one way or another. And we'll talk about that, but something magical happened at 9 months. My first sponsor had gotten drunk. Why wouldn't she? I mean, I had chosen her. You know why? Because she had blonde hair, she had gold earrings on, and she was wearing a white suit. Aren't those great qualifications for a sponsor? I didn't know anything about her. And, you know, she went off and got drunk, and I got another... Anyway, these two fellas knew that I didn't have a sponsor. They said, "You have to do the steps. I'm 9 months clean and sober." And I said, "I don't know how." I couldn't believe those words had come out of my mouth. I always thought, you know, "I've studied theology. I know more than you do." "Yeah, right." "You're dressed nicely, and I'm the one with the teeth knocked out and the whatever." And so they took me through the steps. And, you know, I think back to that period. I couldn't read. You know, I couldn't put two thoughts together. They read the book to me, and they took the time. They said, "If you'll come an hour and a half early, we'll do the steps with you." And people started to ask me to be accountable for myself. What a gift that is. And then I got a sponsor with a big boot. And he asked me to be accountable. And he used the boot on my behind if I wasn't accountable. It was wonderful. Anyway, those two men took me through the steps. And something in me changed. And, you know, eventually I was sober 1 year, and I thought I'd never teach again. I love to teach. I would love to teach more than I love to eat, I think. Not at that Thai restaurant, though. We went to a wonderful restaurant last night. Oh, my God. Anyway, I heard the voice that said, look in the paper and see if there are any teaching jobs. We get paid very well in Canada, you know, and I was making $2.20 an hour. I thought I'd never teach again. And within 2 days, I had a job. And, you know, my life has been full of that kind of stuff when it has been necessary. You know, it says God will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And that's a lesson that is repeated to me. I'm in a very difficult situation now. Something is happening in my life, which I won't talk about right now. But I'm learning that again. I can't fix it. I can never, you know, when I get to a place where I'm trying to decide how I'm going to fix the world and make it the way I want it to be, never works. The lessons are really always the same. They're just the same lessons. Life cycles around. Have you noticed that if you're sober a while? How many are here for their first retreat? Fabulous, fabulous. Wonderful. Let's give them a hand. You know, I got sidetracked before. I was going to say, I'd really recommend that you take a little time. I know that being with other people is exciting and it's wonderful and all that, and do that. But try and take some time for God, too, so that you can take a look at what's happening in your life. I just want to take a little more time to talk about a few things, and then we'll bring this to a close, because there's lots more to come, isn't there? S'mores? Big mouth, eh? Big mouth. Okay. When I was sober the first time, when I was in AA the first time, Chuck Chamberlain used to come to Prince Albert, and he used to set me down. Cease would sick him on me. Do you know who Chuck Chamberlain is?
Yeah.
Okay. For those of you who don't, he was a wonderfully spiritually oriented member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want to know the kinds of things that he taught, it's a retreat of his was transcribed into a book called A New Pair of Glasses. And one of the things in that book, he says God is everything. Thank God he had read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he believed that God was everything. And he used to draw this. And he'd say, Mildred, God is everything. You know, you're looking for all kinds of stuff. You're not going to find it. God is life, and God is love, and God is everything. And if God is everything, you know, in the chapter to the agnostics, it says, the day will come when you have your head in a vice. Well, it doesn't say that, but it says, when faced by a self-imposed crisis, you will have to make a decision. I can't make it for you. You can't make it for me. You can't make it for your sponsees or your sponsor or your children. It's between you and your soul. Is God everything or is God nothing? See, and that brings up a point, doesn't it? If I say God is everything, the next question is, what does that mean? If God is everything, then God is here. Hmm? What does that mean? Where do you see God? Is he in the air? Is he in the carpet? What does that mean? Does your intellect have any truck with that? See, I think we rely on some things. We think we can think it through. The book says, the main problem rests in the mind. You know, I almost died because I didn't understand that. I thought it said the main problem rests in the intellect. Intellect is fine. Intellect functions through the brain. It's good for driving our car and running our lives and reading books and all that kind of thing. But for soul work, it's not worth... How are you going to understand God is everything with your intellect? I don't know. But I can tell you that if I get still and I look within and say to my soul, do you know that God is everything? I know the answer. My soul knows the answer. Now, in the book it says the main problem rests in the mind. And I used to dismiss that statement because I thought it said in the intellect. Well, there's nothing wrong with my intellect. And I'm going to add something for you. There's nothing wrong with your intellect either. You can read and write and you can do all kinds of things and make decisions and think about things and all kinds of stuff. And the day you put down your spacesuit and wherever you move on, that you're not going to need the intellect anymore. It's for this world, not for the next one. It's done. So whatever I have for this world, I know that's of relative importance. It's not of absolute importance. What is of absolute importance is, what is not my spacesuit? See, the astronaut never mistakes his spacesuit for who he is, does he? And I must never mistake my body for who I am. I am something that is not about these atoms and molecules, or my intellect, which is dependent on the brain. The book says the main problem rests in the mind. What could that mean? And I'm not going to get too technical. You know, if you start thinking id, super id, unconscious, subconscious, da-da-da-da-da, you go to one psychiatrist or one psychologist, and they identify it one way. And then another one comes along, and before you know it, you're so caught up in all the stuff of the intellect, you forget the main problem rests in the mind. Where is that? The main problem is inside. In my values. That's the way I see it. My inner world. The world that you can't see. You can see this outer piece, but you can't see the inner world, except as it manifests through what I think, do, and say. See? My values, my beliefs, my memories, my old ideas, all that stuff that drives our life. We think we drive it with the intellect. Forget it. You ever make a resolution that you didn't keep? You know, I think of things like, if to clarify this, you know, I think of things like sometimes, you know, people weigh 200 pounds too much. The doctor takes them in and says, look at this. Look at your liver. Look at your organs. God, this is bad. You've got to lose weight. Yes, doctor. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And they know that as they mean it, because the intellect recognizes the truth of that. And then they walk out of the doctor's office and buy a gallon of ice cream because they're never going to eat again for sure. Right? We do the same with the booze. Yes, doctor, I know that I have to stop drinking. Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember once saying to the RCMP, if you just will understand how sad and depressed I was, and that's why I don't know where my car is, and please go find it for me. And I did this and I did that, and, you know, my tracks aren't so good. You know, but that ex-husband of mine, whom they knew, you know, we're separated, I'm sad about that, da 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 da. And he said, you know, Mrs. Frank, he said, if you will promise me that you will not drink again, we won't charge you with anything, and we'll get the helicopter and we'll find your car. I said, of course I won't drink again. I knew there was a taxi waiting for me at the bottom of the steps, and I really meant what I said till I got about two steps from the taxi, when I said, let's go to the liquor store and celebrate. Hey? Where was I? What am I talking? Oh, mind. So, you know, intellectually we get stuff. And then we go and do exactly what drives that whole engine, that inner world. You ever have somebody say to you, I really love you so much? And inside you hear the voice that says, he doesn't love me, he doesn't care about me. That's what I'm talking about, the inner world. You look in the mirror, somebody has told you how good you look today. You look and you hear the voice that says, you're ugly. You're ugly. You're not smart. You're this, you're that. That's the inner world. That's where the problem rests. And that's where all the change has to take place. So Chuck used to... He used to take that diagram and he'd say, you know, Mildred, you are already as perfect as you will ever be. I thought, he's crazy for sure. And he'd say, you already know everything that you could know. How's that possible? Well, Chuck knew that the inner world was the essence of God, the God force that lives in us always. Is perfect right now. Always will be. The prodigal daughter, that spacesuit can get cleaned up, the inside. She always belonged in the Father's house. And the Father knows that. We always belong there. And when we say, I know who I am, we're home. It's as simple as that. If you choose to live in the outer world of the body and the human experiences and the old ideas and what the unconscious tells you and what Mama said and Papa said and all that, I think the body is a sacred place. I think it's wonderful to have this body, but it's not who I am. It's simply my classroom because I get to find out body, and then I have to deal with each of you. And I believe the secret is that I can come to the place where I can see the God in myself, and I can see the God in you, and then treat you accordingly. Not this idea, you're crap heads. I'm going to go to God and get spiritual so that I can survive living with you. But you begin to see the wonder of this thing, which is really what spirituality is all about. And what really excites me is that science is getting to the same place. Einstein said it. See, each of these is you and me and all 6.5 billion of us, including our politicians and our murderers and our child molesters and everybody. It's not dependent on what they do. You know, it's dependent on the fact if God is everything, they're included in there. Not their behavior, not your behavior, not my behavior, the God self in us. That's what the deal is about, waking up to that and then living from that place. You know what Einstein said? He said, it's an optical delusion that there are 6.5, he didn't say 6.5 billion. He said it's an optical delusion that there are all these things, people here. There's only one of us here because he was recognizing there's one life force. The same force that beats my heart beats the heart of Saddam Hussein. Isn't that interesting? And the same life force that looks at me and says, oh, I love that Mildred, looks at Saddam Hussein and says, I love Saddam Hussein. And the same life force that beats my heart and your heart beats the heart of that person who's molesting a child. You can't get away from that. You know, we're not saying that their actions are okay, but that's not who we are. Where does it come from? Because we're asleep. One of the great masters put it this way. He said, all suffering, not some, all comes from forgetting who we are. This isn't about fixing somebody else. The steps are not about fixing somebody else. The steps are about you and your relationship with God. About finding out who you believe. I believe that God lives in me. I believe I'm a God being. And I believe I live in this body so that I can really wake up some more. Because I've got to wake up. If I'm going to think kindly, what was the great teacher doing here? What did he say? He said, don't judge other people. Like the things that he said, they're all in the program. It's all about how we come to see ourselves. And that's why tomorrow morning we're going to start with this idea that we are a case of mistaken identity. And because we haven't got that right, we're in such pain. And then because we have those weird bodies that don't process alcohol, are there any Al-Anons in here? Yes? Or is this just basically AA?
Double winner.
Okay. It doesn't matter. I don't care if you're sex whatever. Or, I mean, either. See, what I think happens is when we don't know who we are, what happens is our false self does the talking. And our false self, and that's where the suffering comes from. You know, when you get into the present moment and you're totally present to this life force and to the beauty of what who you are and the beauty of who everybody else is, there's no pain in that moment. I don't care what's happening in your life. You know, I've had stress this last year. Sometimes my heart would be pounding, but I could get into the present moment and I knew everything was just fine. It's when I start projecting and thinking I'm going to fix the future based on what happened in the past, that's when I get really screwed up. All I need at that point is a drink to be a real screw up. Anyway, so I'm going to bring this to an end. There were other things. Anyway, I think it's about waking up, you know. It's about waking up. And the program says that. You know, you come here, you think it's about getting sober. That's just putting the symptom of the problem away. The problem is not the booze. The booze is the answer. The booze is the anesthetic. The booze is what allows us to stay here until we can deal with the problem. And that's why from time to time we take a look at these steps. You know, I think these questions are really, really important. We'll put them up if anybody wants to think about them. Who am I? How does life work? Does life work because I'm a good girl? Does life work because I go to lots of meetings? Does life work because I make nice meals for my kids? Does life work good because of whatever you can think? Because I've got powerful friends. Oh, that's a good one. What about I've got a 6-figure bank account? Maybe I've got a 7-figure bank account. Maybe I drive a BMW. Maybe I've got a 6-bedroom house. Who knows what it could be? Is that how life works? Is that how I'm going to feel safe? Or do I feel safe because I'm made out of God? You can kill my body, but you can't touch who I am. You can't touch who I am. How do I get along? Are those powerful friends going to see to it that I get along? The spiritual law receives the direct impress of our thought and acts upon it. Watch out what you think. I have heard people say in AA, it doesn't matter what you think as long as you act right. How can you act right if you don't think right? And I know thinking right isn't going to keep you sober. I know you've got to go into action, and we'll talk about that. But I think there comes a point where I've got to stop what's going on in here. Psychologists tell us we think 72,000 thoughts a day, and that 99% of them are the thoughts we thought yesterday, and round and round and round it goes. That's why I wonder why the laughter. That's why I, you know, retreats excite me, because I think it's an opportunity to really take a look at that stuff and to take a look at what's going on inside. People say, I can't get hold of my thoughts. And I say to you, if that's what you're saying, if you can't, who can? There's no God out there with a magic wand that's going to say, bingo, Linda, no more negative thoughts. It's really important, because the spiritual law receives the direct impress of our thought and acts upon it. You can't think one thing like, I'm stupid, I'm ugly, I'm this, I'm that, and have a good life. One of my teachers also told me this. He said, we're not here to set it right. We're here to see it right. I'm not here to fix you. I'm not here to set you right. Last thing in my mind, I'm simply here to express some of the things that I see about life. It's not about, you know, I think about those 15 years I had in the convent. I would have sworn I was there to set everybody right. I think I did more harm than good. But the fact is, I think now, if I see it right, then I'm going to radiate something different. You know, you've known people and I've known people. They can tell you how you should live, but you want to get away from them because... Probably I was category one for that. So, to me, that's the healing diagram. I'm part of it, no matter how it feels. We'll get into that. Look what the book tells us. What's the book about? It's to help us find the power that will solve a problem. It doesn't say solve your problems. You don't have problems. I never have problems. I have problem. And this is always my problem, that I think I'm separate. I'm separate from God, and I'm separate from you, so I can step on you, and I can get my way and twist the world around to get what I want. And if I get what I want, I'll be okay. Anybody identify with that? Good. Good.
You got five.
Okay, I'm rounding up. What did Dr. Bob say? He said, be sure that your relationship with God is right, and great things will come to pass for you and countless others. Boy, that's a powerful statement. I've tried to be sure that my relationship with other people is right, so they wouldn't hurt me, so they'd give me what I want, so they'd make me feel safe and all that. And he says, be sure that your relationship with God is right, and then great things will come to pass. And that's what the doing of the steps is about. Bill says, we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension. And I say to you, if you're alcoholic the way I'm alcoholic, you have been touched by the hand of God, or you wouldn't be here tonight, clean and sober. The miracle, whether it happened gradually or whether it happened in lightning speed, doesn't matter. You have been touched by the hand of God, and if you've been touched by the hand of God, you've been rocketed into the fourth dimension. The question is, do you like living there? Or do you like the flesh pots of Egypt? And then he says, we have a way out. I thought of that. We discussed that at our meeting the other night. You know, I've got this thing going on in my life that seems like such an albatross. What are you fussing about? You have a way out. Put it in God's hands and go to bed and sleep. Forget it. It says we need a vital spiritual experience. Vital. Not half-assed. Not sleepy. A vital. Something that I can live with. I like to say something that will happen so that you can take it with you into the car. You can take it home wherever you go, whatever it is. And then that entire psychic change. Okay, we'll leave this. If anybody chooses to do this, I'd like you to take a look at your life and these areas: spiritual, emotional, physical, financial, social, work, family, and your material world. Which of those areas is going really good? Which of those areas is the pits? Maybe one is the pits. Okay? Try and figure out which area in my life. Maybe none is the pits. Maybe you're in an infatuation. Nothing looks bad then, does it? But think about which area would you like to needs attention. If you say, I'm going to work on the mall this weekend, you can't do that. But which area would you like to see some improvement in? Because the others will be affected. You improve in one area, but you focus on one. Define the situation and clarify what is out of harmony. The situation in my life, what I mean by that is, what's out of harmony? I have an old message that says I'm not safe. It's an old message that, and all my life I've looked for men, women, anybody who can do for me, and nobody can. And I've pulled a real naughty situation into my life. And it's not about the situation, you know what it's about? It's about putting a human being before God. That's what I mean by this. Why is that situation out of control? And lastly, if you could set a purpose when you leave here on Sunday, what would you like to see different in you? What area do you want to work on a little bit? What would you like to see different? Would you like to make a decision that I'm going to treat him better? I'm going to stop criticizing her? Or I'm going to do my prayer life different? Whatever. Just some ideas so that you know, if you want to pin something down, that you have something to focus on. Okay? Okay. So, before we go, let's just take a few minutes and spend it in silence. I once went to see a minister, and he said to me, I can't fix you. He said, come, sit here with me in the silence, because this is where God is. Don't have to talk. As Pascal said, God's voice is the voice of silence. And so it is. Amen. You are an absolutely fabulous group to talk to.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.